more product out. And yeah, let's you and Sheree and I we can all touch base about how we want to do tomorrow afternoon. I wasn't up in time for breakfast.
That's it. Thank you very much.
We had exactly that conversation 2 minutes ago.
Because I just left mine over there.
Oh, right. This is this is mine. It turned out to be Eleni Kondouriadis's dossier, because I wrote, she recently was up for promotion to professor. But it's a book which is on basically the war, and I mean, it's very interesting. It's war environmentalism.
I'm going to stand in the corner for this. This room is for the film department. They usually use it for screenings. So if you go just half a meter to the right, you have this blinding projector eye in your face. That's why I think for the talk why it was so hard the other day, is because it's not really meant to do this kind of work.
Yeah.
I'm tremendously happy to be able to introduce Jason. There's a scene in Henry James's The Bostonians when Basil Ransom, who's a southerner who's come up and he's interested in leading a life in the literary world of the North, and he visits Verena Tarrant in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's kind of awkward meeting, and they're sitting around, and Verena says, well, you probably want to go visit Harvard and look at the campus, but the shame is that it's actually, there's very little to see there. It's visually kind of uninteresting. You have this sort of idea of what Harvard looks like. And as is always the case, James is right. He's right on two accounts. One, Harvard is actually pretty uninteresting to see. There's not, you know, despite the busloads of tourists that come in, there's not that much to see. But he's also right in the sense that the real life of the mind, the real excitement of intellectual activity, doesn't really lend itself to be congealed. I'm saying the process of the life of the mind doesn't lend itself to be congealed or commoditized in the forms that the commonplace market traditionally understands. Many of you heard Neil Lazarus speak yesterday, and you will know that Neil is the sort of the sun around which many of us revolve. He's the magnetic pole.
And not that old.
Should I make an energy resource? But if there's a second magnetic pole for us at work, it would be Jason, whose work, partly initially I think from Charest, but also through many of Neil's students, has been absolutely transformative and revolutionary for us. It's been a kind of second education. It's completely re-engineered the kind of work that I've been doing. I'm on print record as saying this, so I'll say it again in public. For me, the series goes Henri Lefebvre, David Harvey, Jason Moore. I consider Jason's work to be of that level of significance. It's tremendously important. And so it's a pleasure that he's as generous to devote his time to coming to work on several occasions to speak. We really have been tremendously fortunate of that. Once James Baldwin was asked, James Baldwin, the great Black American fiction writer and civil rights activist, he was once asked about, wasn't it tiring to give so many lectures, to go on the lecture circuit to small rooms? And he said, well, you have to remember that there's always somebody quiet in the back of the room who really needs to hear what you're saying and is going to carry on what you're saying. So you have to remember never to let the exhaustion of the these repeated schedulings take place, because there's a magical moment in there. If you might think about Benjamin's notion of the shard of activity, which could bring the messiah time, the yetzeit to the sort of constant moment. This is exciting for us because there's not one person in the back of the room, but you are the room. You are the agents of change. And so what I want to highlight for this talk, rather than give a sort of more traditional talk, such as to mention Jason's new book from Verso, which will come out in the spring, Capitalisms and the Web of Life, but to sort of to remind you that this is actually one of those magical moments in your career because of your ability to sort of hear Jason talk. Some of what he may say may seem new, and all new things may have the sense of being slightly opaque. But I'd encourage you to pay as close attention to the implications of what Jason is saying, because there will come a time when you'll say, I heard Jason back in the day, before he was all known. George Sorel, a very famous anarchist philosopher, asked the question, how do you teach a weakly literate population into the philosophy of Marx? People who really can't sit down and read the entire volume of Capital. And he came up with the notion of the demonstration or the event, right? This goes on to sort of Badu, that he had this notion that if it's a sort of left version of the primal scene, that if you're in a demonstration, in a moment, you can sort of see the entirety of capitalist exploitation and the history of that, and you can become transformed. And this is a kind of a touchstone for the 20th century Marxist debates about social transformation. I'm not in the anarchist line, so I have a fair amount of suspicion of that. But if that is the case, then surely today will be one of those moments. So it's with great pleasure that I hand the podium over to Jason.
Well, thank you, Stephen, for that wonderful introduction. And for me, coming to work is always a kind of great inspiration and motivation to raise my game, not only in terms of trying to say something new, but also in trying to communicate more clearly so that we can push forward to encourage, to nurture to facilitate what I believe is a fundamental paradigm shift in the modern world system, that the old model of capitalism and nature, society and nature, the critique of dualisms that has for so long been a staple of the radical critique, has now finally reached the point where we can not just critique but transcend this logic of dualism, this meta-logic of dualism that is that has been in some ways etched into our intellectual DNA so much that it has become very difficult for us to speak of the dialectics of the web of life and of humanity in the web of life without these dualisms of economy and polity and culture and above all, nature and society, nature and culture. So what I want to try to do today is to lay this out as a series of openings, as a series of methodological invitations for how we move from the philosophical position, which I believe was Marx's position, of humanity in nature, to workable analytics, to methods, to narrative strategies, to retell the history of the modern world with a lot of priorities in mind, but one above all, how do we come to grips with the unfolding crisis of modernity in the 21st century? And to come to grips with it means to develop a mode of theorizing, a paradigm that transcends the dualisms that drip with blood and dirt every bit as much as the violence of primitive accumulation in the early modern era. And in fact, one of the things that I will talk about today is the distinctiveness of capitalist environment making as a praxis of external nature. And the praxis of external nature was there from the very beginning. The project to create nature as external, to create space as flat, to create time as linear, and to forge a model of world accumulation and world power on this basis. So in my view, in times of historical crisis, as Marx reminds us, ideas themselves become a material force. And the emergent bourgeoisies and imperial states of early modern Europe grasp this readily as any grouping of social power and wealth ever had. That to seize upon the praxis of external nature and to create nature as external was a fundamental act in the creation of modern capitalism. And that fundamental act had one extraordinary implication, which was to create nature as cheap, to create cheap nature. And it is that cheap nature that is today coming unraveled. And I'll only talk about that in very broad strokes because for this talk, what I want to do is to open up a series of discussions and we can get into the empirical elements of the present crisis and the end of what I call cheap nature and the four cheaps in the discussion. So, of course, we have two models. We have one that's capitalism plus nature. This is the stock and trade of the green critique, of the red critique, the red-green critique. Everyone says, well, we have capitalism over here in one box. We have nature over here in the other box. And the nature of the crisis today, so to speak, is one of convergence. So this is the line of somebody like John Bellamy Foster, but of course many other people. It is an advance over the crisis discourse of the 70s, of course. However, it aids and abets a continued view of capitalism as a system of political economy that is fundamentally outside the web of life. And so we can see in one after another major work on the post-2008 world economy that nature exists as context, as something that's out there. Oh, yes, we have to deal with it. But let's unpack the political economy. I want to suggest that that's fundamentally false, and it's fundamentally at odds with Marx's philosophy of internal relations and with how Marx regards the law of value. That is, what is valuable in historical capitalism? And so I'll talk about that. But in brief, what I would say is that the law of value, the law of abstract social nature, and the primacy of labor productivity in the accumulation of wealth is, in fact, a co-produced reality. and that it turns decisively on the appropriation of the unpaid work energy of nature as a whole, including human beings outside circuit of capital, which is historically the majority and still today the majority. So our move is capitalism in nature. So this is a way of highlighting the decisive methodological, theoretical, and narrative analytical moves that we need to make to take this philosophy of humanity and nature, which now everyone embraces, to a practice, an analytical practice, and a political practice. And though I won't talk very much about it in this presentation itself, I think it bears mentioning that the movements, in some respects, are very ahead of the curve here, that there is what I would call a new ontological politics that is represented perhaps most dramatically by the food sovereignty claim of Via Campesina, a family of peasant and farmers' movements, that says food is about power, food is about nature, food is about the right to cultural determination. It is all of these at the same time. It doesn't have a social moment that can be hived off from its biophysical moment. In fact, these are all a dynamic whole. And this kind of ontological politics is a dramatic and revolutionary rupture with previous demands of anti-systemic movements, which sought to maximize the productivist potential and to redistribute wealth within that framework. This calls for an entirely new ontology and an entirely new civilization based on that ontology. So how do we do this? How do we translate this philosophy of humanity and nature into an analytics of capitalism in nature? And I think greens and red greens have come part of the way. So it's the one system, two system problem. One system, yeah, humans are part of nature, but we can stick with the old analytics. We can stick with the dualisms. We can keep pretending that humans are outside of nature, nature is outside of humans, and you can look at these as autonomous systems. And I would suggest that this is problematic, not just materially and historically, but also it betrays a kind of vulgar materialism that is quite strong in both mainstream and radical green approaches, both the Bellamy Foster kind of wing and the Anthropocene argument, which essentially says ideas don't really matter. And I don't need to tell all of you. And so saying capitalism in nature entails a double shift, and we'll have a couple of double moves in this talk, so bear with me. One is from environment to environment making. We need to stop viewing the environment as this thing, as this object without history, we have to quit seeing this as something that's outside of us, but rather something that is always outside and inside and flowing through us. And we need to move from environment making to thinking about environment making as just moving the earth, of clearing the fields, of digging the earth, doing all those things, to understanding that environment making includes the totality of world historical movements of ideas, power, and reproduction understood as a dialectical and historical whole. And this means, let's go back to Marx and work. And although one of the most famous passages in the sort of Marx and ecology renaissance that we've seen over the past decade is that capitalism degrades the soil and the worker, and that's really the culminating words to his discussion of large-scale industry. In some ways, Marx's discussion of work is much more illuminating and much more fundamental. And though I won't have time to talk about it today, go back and look at this discussion of the working day, how in this passage that none of the red greens ever quote, that Marx says, well, capitalism snatches the life of the worker just as much as the farmer robs the soil. And in that, Marx isn't saying, oh, here's the worker over here and here's nature over there. No, he's saying that there is a singular metabolism and a singular process. So instead of this discourse and metabolic rift and the separation of humanity and nature, I say we move with Marx to metabolic shift, to understanding that there is a singular metabolism of power, nature, production, and reproduction in the modern world. So in this opening passage of on labor that Marx gives us in Capital, page 283, if you're curious, that humanity acts on nature. Okay, we know that. But external nature also acts upon human nature. And that it's not just the consequences of those moves that matter. Green thought has got that really well. Well, we're going to study the consequences. This is what I would call the consequentialist bias of green thought. Let's look at the consequence. No, for Marx, it is in the movement of acting upon nature or of the web of life acting upon humans that each moment and the relations between the two are transformed. They're reworked. So it's not just the consequences. Those unfold into a cascading train of events that remake humanity and nature. But it's in the act of doing itself. But this is a vexing problem that we'll get to in just a moment, because we've used, certainly in environmental studies, we've used a lot of words to summarize the interactions of humanity with the rest of nature. But we haven't come up with a vocabulary yet, although I'll make my proposal in a moment. We haven't come up with a vocabulary to name the relation itself. So we talk about a nature-society dialectic, which is a term I've used plenty, but by the way, it's not a dialectic. Okay, because it's premised on a separation rather than, as any sort of first-year student reading dialectics and in discussions will learn, it's about the relations that matter. So what I would stress here is that this is not an argument for a macro perspective. I think macro-micro is another one of these dualisms that we just need to do away with. We do know that capitalism has many patterns of divergence and many patterns of coherence, and that these patterns are not formed somehow above, in some atmospheric way. The capitalism's world historicity moves through everyday life and everyday nature and emerges through these relations. That my colleague Wendy Wolford said one time, well, Jason, you're doing an ethnography of world capitalism. I never understood what that meant until a few years ago. But it means we don't start with a set of a priori constructions in this sort of sterilized world system, positivist, structuralist kind of setup. Like, here's the model. I'm going to work out the premises. Rather, we're going to come in with a set of premises that are essentially eductive. That is, aimed at drawing out new connections between humans and the rest of nature as an unbroken circle of being, knowing, and doing. And so this allows us to look at what capitalism does in a new way. That it allows us to understand that capitalism from the long 16th century is indeed premised on a praxis of external nature. So its project is to create external nature. But its process is always to bring the whole of nature into its circuits, but in some ways that I think until now are not very well understood, although they've been frequently suggested. And we're going to get to that in just a bit. So this is the kind of thinking that has guided the conversations, including with a number of you in this room, that have guided and informed the world ecology perspective as it has emerged over the past few years. And this says that capitalism represents a particular form of human sociality, a word I absolutely hate to say because it's so ugly, but it gets us out of this society nature kind of box, and that these forms of sociality unfold within the web of life, not just outside of us, but the web of life is a flow of flows. So there is no, certainly in the era since humans have been on this planet, there's no nature that's outside of humans any more than there are any humans that are outside of nature. And that doesn't mean that there isn't some nature in general that we can acknowledge, just like Marx acknowledges production in general. But foolish would be the political economist that used the concept of production in general to talk about neoliberalism's flexible accumulation. However, the same realization has not dawned upon the green and red-green accounts of environmental change in the neoliberal era, where nature in general is still the concept that's used to talk about what's going on. Just as there is a historical capitalism for the past six centuries and a succession of historical capitalisms over successive long centuries of development, there is also a historical nature that is co-produced by capitalism and the rest of nature in the modern era. And so to move from nature in general, production in general, reproduction in general, to successively more historical and determinate forms is part of what we are emphasizing in world ecology. We're not saying, oh, here's a model, go use it. We're saying here is a framework for theorizing. So this says, well, capitalism doesn't act upon nature, although this is in fact the conceit of the Cartesian project of this praxis of external nature, that human activity is always within the web of life, and that calls for a series of, I think, fairly radical reconceptualizations of what culture, politics, economics, and so forth really mean. People all the time say to me, well, Jason, you know, you're just talking about capitalism and this economic system, and we need to put, you're ignoring all this other stuff. I'm saying, well, quite the contrary, because part of what world ecology argues against is this view that capitalism is an economic system or even a social system. In fact, the dualist framework undermines our effort to understand the specific forms of class, race, gender, nature, nation, and all these other relations, that the dualist project, which brackets the question of the web of life, undermines our efforts to understand so-called social specificity. So if you want to understand, I mean, I'm an early modern historian, so if I want to understand slavery, there's no way to understand the history of slavery bracketing the rest of nature. But neither is it possible to understand something like Fordism. Are we to understand Fordism without cheap oil? Are we to understand Fordism without the cheap food of the petro-farming, green revolution, industrial agriculture model that comes up in the 30s? So this means that capitalism, and we can multiply the concepts, but I'm trying to keep it, well, as simple as I can here today, is that it's not just capitalism, it's imperialism, it's the history of family formation, it's a history of racial orders, that these are always already co-produced by humans and the rest of nature in that are bundled. So imperialism, or the history of slavery, or the European family form in the early modern era, these are all co-produced, and they're bundled. They're bundles of human and extra-human nature, and at the same time, they're bundles of the material and the symbolic. Because I think one of the conceits of a certain kind of Marxism has been this, I know that I'm preaching to the choir here, but I think it merits saying again that there is this vulgar materialism that says we can understand the material as somehow neat and tidily separated from the symbolic, which is absolutely historically untenable. You cannot understand the rise of capitalism without understanding the new measures of reality that that emerged through the scientific revolution, the cartographic revolutions, the botanical revolutions, these ways of mapping and quantifying and rationalizing and making the world legible for the power and capital of European states and bourgeoisies. So, world ecology, just to make this clear, not the ecology of the world, but a world ecology as the accumulation of capital, the pursuit of power, the co-production of nature, not as separate spheres, but as dialectical processes in which each is implied in the other. And what this means, too, is that world ecology is not a theory. Although I have plenty of theories about how capitalism works, those are just one of a series of possibilities that emerge from a historically grounded post-Cartesian mode of theorizing. Now, we've had plenty of really wonderful post-Cartesian critiques and theorizing. We've all read Donna Haraway. We've all read Braun and Castry. We've all read Latour. But how do we historically ground it in the movements of capitalism as a world system? Not capitalism as a world system as a theoretical construct either. I mean to say that modernity is in itself a real place, a real historical, geographical place with its own culture, its own modes of accumulating power and capital, and so on and so forth, that we can, by recognizing this, we can move beyond this kind of critical anthropology, critical geography kind of move of invoking a local global dialectic, which is, by the way, hardly ever dialectical. It just means we're going to cite David Harvey or whoever our famous theorist is that we really like as a way of setting up the global context. Well, we need to move beyond this dualism as well, because to take nature seriously means to move through the soil, move through the bodies, move through the fields and the forests. As part of a historical method that moves from the point of production and reproduction to the globalizing structures and structures and patterns of power and accumulation and knowledge. So we want to look at world ecology as a framework with many possible many possible sort of theories coming out of it. And that I think opens up some new questions, which I want to get to in just a moment. The first is, how do we name this relation? Well, the idea that there is an active dialectic of species and environment has been with us for a while. I think probably most effectively pioneered by the great Marxist geneticists Richard Lewontin and Richard Levins, who in my view were decades ahead of their time. And their work repays close study today. But I've taken this word oikos from Theophrastus and sort of reworked it for my own purpose, because we need a way to name this relation. We need to go beyond, well, here's human and extra-human nature, nature and society. We need to understand, we need to have a way of coming to grips with this dynamic, creative, historical process of life-making, of environment-making, of making these relations. So how do we talk about this relation? Well, we need to have a conceptual vocabulary. And in fact, I think that's been one of the problems that the critique of Cartesian dualisms and dualist thought has really encountered, is it seemed like every decade or so, some major theorist, first Birch and Cobb in the early 1980s, and then David Harvey said, well, look, we don't really have a unified vocabulary for bringing together the relations of humans and the rest of nature. We should really get to doing that. And that was two decades ago that David writes this. So finally I said, well, okay, let's start with the oikos. Maybe there are better terms, but we can begin with this. And so we can include within the oikos not just this kind of material metabolisms, but also that there are processes of thought, symbolic production, of collective memory that are embodied thought. That thought and thinking, too, is part of nature. So we would ask, instead of, well, what do humans do to the rest of nature? We would say, well, how do humans fit into the web of life? And I think that this means coming to terms with, I mean, we could multiply this list much beyond three, but these three crucial meanings, that is, moving from nature as object to nature as matrix. Nature is the field upon which human life and human civilization unfolds, simultaneously transforming the nature of that field and transforming themselves. But of course, then there's the praxis of external nature. So this is nature as tap and sink. And then finally, there's also human nature. How do we deal with this question? Humans as one species in the web of life. And of course, we're not in short supply of a lot of good and a lot of bad literature on human nature, but it doesn't really, there have been very few attempts to put the production and reproduction of life at the center of our understanding of capitalism and of civilizations. So how do we bring in this sort of missing element of not just the reproduction of labor power, although that's part of it, but the production and reproduction of life, of humans, and the rest of life, and how does that work within capitalism? This is a question that we've only begun to raise and only begun to explore. So this is a way of asking, you know, how do we understand history, including the history of the present, as this co-produced reality, not just as something that we tack on a set of environmental factors? The way that I've started to think about this, and this has very much come out of my conversations with Mike and Sheree and Kirsten and Stephen and other comrades, is that we need to understand that when we talk about human and extra-human natures, we're not simply restating a dualism. We need to understand the oikos as what they call a double internality. That is, capitalism in nature, nature in capitalism. So to say that Wall Street organizes nature or capitalism is a way of organizing nature is not to restate this kind of Promethean, productivist, capital can do whatever it wants to nature, but to say that human activity, that financialization, for instance, is ontologically coincident with and constituted through specifically bundled relations with the rest of nature that are flowing through us as well as moving around us and we are acting on the rest of nature. So that means that the production of nature is always the co-production of nature, not these kind of two ontologically independent units, but rather this evolving mosaic of interdependent flows. And this means that modernity or capitalism doesn't have this sort of external way of organizing nature, although that is in fact how capitalists often think about it, and is part of this sort of embodied thought, embodied common sense of capitalism, but rather that that capitalist organization, markets, systems of production and reproduction are in themselves ways of channeling and negotiating and reworking the oikos of the singular metabolism. And the dialectical moment comes here, that in the process of moving and representing and channeling and doing all of this, that the original terms of the dialectic dissolve because they acquire new properties. So in the words of Alberto Finelli, a concept that is not pregnant with difference is not a dialectical concept. And that is a very challenging statement to come to grips with because it asks us to consider, are the concepts that we're using pregnant with difference, pregnant with their own undoing? So this is part of this effort to move from environment to environment making and to extend the oikos beyond earth moving to the processes of symbolic production. And in my bailiwick, it's questions of cartography, of botanical and agronomic knowledge, of quantification. This extends beyond Foucault's sort of account of rationalizing and regularizing and coding human populations. It includes that. But I think what we need to do is to understand that capitalism does the same thing to human and extra-human populations, to geographies across this divide. And this is what I call the production of abstract social nature. That is the production of symbolic and material bundles of nature that are, in Scott's sense, rendered legible, but much more than just being rendered legible, they are actively transformed in the interests of facilitating capital accumulation. And such movement of the sort of dramatic restructuring of historical nature and the production of new forms of abstract social nature accompany the transitions from one phase of capitalism to another. So the shift from Fordism to neoliberalism, to take a rough and ready distinction in the 1970s, gives rise to not only new calculative mentalities in finance, so Black-Scholes equation and all the rest of this risk evaluation quantification, but also, of course, the molecular and biotechnological revolutions and much remote sensing and the proliferation of satellites and other mapping technologies. That these are about the production of new forms of knowledge, but also a new historically specific practice of external nature so as to, in my view, suck up the last, more or less the last of cheap nature that remained. So this shifts the kinds of questions that we ask about the human relation to the rest of nature. Instead of what does capitalism do to nature, we take that question. That's an important question in its own right. But more fundamental, it is how does nature work for capitalism? How does capitalism take the work energy of the biosphere and turn it into value? So that's why I would say that the law of value is the law of cheap nature. Because, and Marx recognizes this quite clearly in his discussion of the human nature of the working day, he says, well, it would seem that the capitalist would prefer to limit the number of hours in the working day so as not to exhaust the labor power, because on the surface it appears that the exhaustion of labor power would lead to rising wages and rising costs. He says, but wait a minute. If the capitalists can get fresh, cheap labor from Ireland, no sweat. That's not a problem. So what he's identifying here is this constant frontier movement that is inscribed in value accumulation to go outside of the circuit of capital. But the problem, of course, is that capital is not so good at going outside of itself. That's why it needs states and other forms of political power. And it needs the procedures of abstract social nature to produce new knowledges, new ways of understanding nature, and the operative word here is new, to bring new, not just new ways of understanding a nature that's already out there, but new ways of understanding the nature that's out there in the process of transforming that nature. That's what moves the world ecology understanding of nature from nature in general to historical nature. So what we're looking at is this basic dynamic that if you take the circuit of capital as a given and you take its own conceits, that the cost of production will continue to rise. Marx, of course, talks about this in terms of what he calls the rising organic composition of capital and the tendency for accumulation to falter as a result. And we can dispense with all the debates about whether or not this was actually, in Marx's view, a prediction of profitability crises or a different way of coming to grips with scarcity or however, whatever we want to make of that. But what I would say is that Marx was essentially correct, that within the limits of the circuit of capital, the cost of production rise and accumulation does falter dramatically. In fact, we see this in every major era of capital accumulation in the modern world history, that the cost of production rise over the course of this. Now, the cost of production is another way of talking about cheap nature. How does cheap nature forcibly created through primitive accumulation, technologically created through the circuit of capital, and symbolically created, although it's more than just symbolic, through the production of abstract social nature. So primitive accumulation, abstract social labor, and abstract social nature form a kind of holy trinity of capitalist praxis. And the trick has always been that in order to advance labor productivity within the commodity system, you have to go outside the commodity system to appropriate cheap nature. And I talk about this in terms of the four cheaps. So the four cheaps are cheap labor power, cheap food, cheap raw materials, cheap energy. And these. So what we're looking at is a process through which recurrently the conditions, the necessary but not sufficient, the necessary conditions for the revival of world accumulation have been the restoration of the four cheaps in some combination. So there's no sort of mechanical preordained set of how these fit together. But these are the four principal forms. There is also, as Stephen is always reminding me, there's always a fifth cheap, which is cheap money, which we're seeing today in unprecedented form. The money has never been so cheap in terms of the rate of interest set by the major central banks of the world as it is today. That is a sign of profound weakness, because it's a sign of what Harvey has taken to calling these days as capitalism as a Ponzi scheme. And that is becoming, seeing how long this can continue. But these four cheaps, interestingly, we become increasingly fungible over the course of capitalist development. We see this rather spectacularly in the latest era, not just materially, as in the rise of flex crops, so sugar cane or palm oil or maize used for multiple purposes, for food, for industrial raw materials, for energy, and so on and so forth. That is not a sign of dynamism. And I know that it's often regarded as that this is the advance of capitalization. And that the advance of capitalization all the way down in the, unfortunately, late Neil Smith's words, is a sign of the new dynamism of capitalism. I want to suggest that it is anything but. That capitalism survives not by capitalizing rapidly, but by appropriating rapidly and using small amounts of capital to set large amounts of cheap nature into play. And So this speaks to, I think, one of the most central lacunae in Marxist political economy, which is to see the problem of the overaccumulation of capital as an economic problem with economic sources. And what it fails to see is that capitalism always, the nature of capitalism, the dynamism of capitalism is to produce more capital than it can invest profitably. Okay, we all know that. But what has been invisibilized by the Cartesian dualism is that the resolution of these surplus capital problems has occurred through these epical innovations, also long recognized, Schumpeter, Baran, and Sweezy, all the rest, by these epical innovations that have opened up cheap nature on an unprecedented scale, scope. So the shipbuilding and cartographic revolutions of early modern Europe, the railroad revolution, the automobile and jet airliner revolutions of the 20th century, that these are rather crude examples, but also very instructive about how these technologies worked by opening up the radically larger expanses of nature to capitalist appropriation rather than through capitalization in itself. So what I would say is that this way of thinking through accumulation must move beyond another way that value theory has been taken in green and red-green theory, which is to say, well, there's value, and value is exchange value, so price, and then there's use value. That's just utility, right? Well, it's surprising. A lot of Marxist ecologists talk in this way, and this says price and utility. Price and utility, you know. What does that sound like? It doesn't sound like Marxist political economy. It sounds a lot like neoclassical reasoning. And there's a kind of neoclassical political economy in red-green thought especially that's dressed up in Marxist language. What I would suggest is that use value is not utility per se, although it encompasses that moment. That use value is not value. It's the negation of value and speaks to this issue of the transformation of the unpaid work energy of humans and the rest of nature and its transformation into value. So in this sense, I wouldn't abandon abstract social labor. I would say that it is a kind of economic expression of a law of value. It's a kind of economic expression of a systemic reality. That the law of value is a systemic relation that encompasses human and extra-human natures, and that the creation of socially necessary labor time, the socially necessary labor time is realized through these dialectics of capitalization and appropriation. This is implicit and sometimes explicit in Marx as well, that if the cost of flax growing goes up, then the value of linen will change. We've long recognized this, but it hasn't really come to the fore until now. So this means going beyond this great slogan that I've used many, many times, so I'm not pointing fingers, or I'm pointing fingers forced at myself. It means moving beyond the exploitation of nature. I don't think that most of human and extra-human nature is exploited. I think that for most of the history of capitalism, that human and extra-human natures have been appropriated. That is the condition for the exploitation of labor power within the commodity system. And I would say also that to paraphrase the old Marxist joke, the only thing worse than being exploited is being appropriated. So we need to understand that the condition for the value of some work is that almost all work by humans and others is devalued. The condition of valuing some work within the commodity system is the radical devaluation and appropriation of most work energy from most of the world. So it's a very strange system that often we see accounts of the exploitation of labor and nature as if what that does is it really takes for granted wage labor as the only form of the capitalist organization of human work, which is entirely false. I mean, and what we need is a more suitable and post-Cartesian way of understanding how capitalism does in fact make distinctions, which I suggest is between human work within the commodity system and the majority of human work, the appropriation of, in Maria Mies's great phrase, of women, nature, and colonies, is in fact what we need to bring into the picture. So it's not just so one of the things that the environmental critique has done is basically completely forget this extraordinary wave of theorizing and debate and study that came out of Marxist feminism in the 1970s and 80s. And so as a consequence, very few people have, aside from Marilyn Waring and a few other people, have tried to put these two together. So I would say that we have a non-identity between the substance of value, which is abstract social labor, which you can think of as sort of the average labor productivity, the average time it takes to make the average commodity in the system. So the substance of value remains abstract social labor, but the historical relations necessary to sustain that system are relations of capitalization and appropriation. So value relations and value are non-identical. And so this means that we need to take much, much more seriously the task, not just of unifying what looks to be the superficially social and the superficially environmental, but also the relations of commodification and uncommodification, and how that frontier is negotiated. I would say that somebody like Nancy Fraser is pointing in this direction quite fruitfully, but she continues to insist that these are background conditions, which they are not. I would say, far from background conditions, these are the foreground conditions of how capital works in the modern world. So we need to take the absurd forms of the ecosystem services debate, but the real contribution of it is to highlight just how much work is, just how much capitalism is really a system that creates islands of capitalization within oceans of appropriation. And I think that's what both the UN Development Program and its report on unpaid work in the world economy, what the ecosystem services studies have done, is to basically point that out to anyone who wants to see, is the other dependence of this of these islands of capitalization on oceans of appropriation. So what does all of this mean in terms of limits? Clearly there are limits. Clearly geology matters, biology matters, what we normally regard as ecology and biospheric, you have the biospheric thresholds argument coming out of the earth sciences, the Anthropocene argument. The problem is that their presentations are so partial that they obscure our understanding of what in fact is going on, and they feed directly into this catastrophist discourse, this apocalypse discourse that has been widely and enthusiastically embraced on the left. And in my friend Larry Lohman's forthcoming essay, he has this wonderful line. He says, stories of apocalypse are always about rule. And I would say that we remember that at every turn when we are in these discussions of, the environment and the future of modernity. That there is a kind of default that I believe comes out of dualism that says catastrophe is coming, the end is, repent, the end times are here. What this has, the consequences of this are profound. They completely negate and marginalize the kind of radical ontological politics that are now emerging around food sovereignty, climate sovereignty, energy sovereignty, which say we need to understand power and nature and democracy and culture as organic wholes. So I would say in looking at the limits of capital today, we look at how human and extra-human nature have fit together over the long durée of capitalist development, and how this is crucially dependent on getting the four cheaps, labor, power, food, energy, raw materials, for free or close to free. This means going beyond this view of nature in general. And nature is external, that is then progressively drawn down through geological exhaustion. This is the peak everything perspective. That geology and biology are implicated in these processes, but we can't take them as self-evident facts, because you have the facts, natural facts, geophysical facts are just that. They are not historical facts. Historical facts appear when you have elements of human activity or extra-human activity that become bundled up with large-scale patterns of power and production and the periods of fundamental rupture in those patterns. And it means really thinking seriously and trying, you know, it's a long process of, I'm a recovering Cartesian myself. How do we move beyond this? Well, nature's out there, right? Nature exists. Nature is eternal. All these things. Okay, yeah, nature, I suppose nature is eternal. Although now we know through string theory and many other developments that there's, you know, time and space are not what we used to think they are. But how do we move from nature in general to historical natures? And how do we treat the problem of nature as not one of a search for basic units, but as a question of layers within layers, of worlds within worlds that are always relational webs? And then how do we recast our political economy so that we stop thinking of endless accumulation as a social process? And that we understand that the endless accumulation of capital turns on this dialectic of capitalization and appropriation, of reproducing life and capital through the circuit of capital, but of also using capital and power and science and all the rest to appropriate for free or low cost the natures outside. And, of course, the natures outside are not infinite. So the limit of capital in that sense is, and the end of cheap nature in that sense, is the exhaustion of capital's relational capacity to secure the free gifts of human and extra-human natures. And we see this today with the ongoing end of the four cheaps. And I know somebody's going to ask me, well, isn't labor still cheap? Look at China, the workshop of the world, where unit labor prices have skyrocketed, manufacturing wages have skyrocketed. You have a serious unraveling of China's cheap labor in the process. So that's crucial to pay attention to. And it means to think the limit of capital, yes, is capital itself, but not the old capital, not the economic capital, but capital is a way of organizing nature. And it's not unique to capitalism. All civilizations unmake themselves. That's why we're not living in the Roman Empire right now. Right? All civilizations have definite patterns of power production and reproduction that allow them to thrive and at some point come unraveled. So what I would suggest is that we understand limits as co-produced through the oikos, as a civilizational relation that operates over long time and large space, and that the specificity of capital is found in this practice of external nature that today confronts declining capacities to appropriate nature for free or low cost. Thank you very much.
Before we go to questions, I just want to point out most of Jason's work is very generously put on his website, which you've put the link on, right?
Absolutely,
hashtag,
yes.
Hashtag Jason Moore.
JasonWMoore.com.
Please, questions.
Hi, Jason. I'll just lead off with a question that you sort of had for me before, but it's kind of also to ask you to elaborate for the audience, which is on the notion of co-production, in that maybe it would be useful to have some actual concrete examples. And I've asked you before about nature's agency as an extra-human nature, what that actually looks like, to get around the argument that this is all overdetermining capital acting on why are we overdetermining this. So I'm asking for some concrete examples. If geological, biological changes, what you have called at points the superweed effect and things like that, can both create opportunities and limits, what does that actually mean in concrete examples of co-production of nature, in the sense of how do we see that not just as the exhaustion of a mine or the exhaustion of the soil and the plantation, and that's
we're running out of oil, we're running out of water.
We've tapped it, we've mined it, it's gone. And also, you know, what does that mean? Does that opportunity both mean that, you know, capitalism has to reconfigure itself, but does it also create other kinds of possibilities, whether that's for democratic action, whether that's for human culture to do something else, something emancipatory, or is it always just producing what you've called elsewhere the ecological revolution, the ecological regime, the ecological revolution? That's mm-hmm. a bit of a messy question, but maybe just some concrete examples might help.
Okay, the first part of your question, I think I can answer really quickly. I think that there one of the tendencies that's emerged out of the critique of dualism is to say, well, nature has agency too. Extra human nature has agency too. I would say that's a very dualist statement. That neither humans nor extra human nature have agency. The agency is always a bundled property. It's always an emergent property of the relation of historically, geographically specific bundles of human and extra human nature. So I think I can segue this into the second question, which is, you can look at, let me give an early modern and late modern example. The early modern example is the sugar slave nexus. So this unfolds through what I've called the sugar commodity frontier, and I know others in this room have done important work on that as well. And the theory of commodity frontiers and the history of sugar commodity frontiers suggests this reality, that it's not even so much about the commodification, although that's a crucial element, but that the precocious character of capitalist technological advance on the frontier is centrally related to its capacity to appropriate cheap natures, cheap labor, and cheap soil, fertile soil, cheap energy, all the rest. So if you look at the history of plantations, the sugar plantations in the 16th and 17th centuries were one of the most prefigurative moments of large-scale industry in the 18th and 19th, especially in the 19th century, not just in terms of capital intensity, but in terms of the coordination of land and labor power through the circuit of capital. So you can read Harry Braverman on the organization of work in the 20th century. You can take that all the way back to the 16th century. And the kicker is the rationalization of work and the rationalization of space, and therefore the rationalization of human and extra-human natures, are dialectically bound. Now, how that works is that combination, the capital intensity, new uncapitalized natures, so the islands, the Atlantic islands, Madeira and Sao Tome, and then Brazil, and then the Caribbean islands. What you saw was a moving frontier that was characterized by this boom and bust. That it was very much co-produced because you have these uncapitalized natures that were not simply waiting for capital to come, but that capital is very adept at activating the work energy of nature and moving it into the circuit of capital. And that process, both because it capitalizes elements of human and extra-human nature and appropriates nature, tends to exhaust the capacity of those natures to provide a rising stream of work energy. The competitive position of any major industrial operation is always vitally dependent on rising labor productivity. Okay, we always know that, but rising labor productivity is always dependent on access to cheap nature. Where does the so-called first industrial revolution? I think the first industrial revolution actually occurs in the 15th and 16th centuries. But in England, you know, what's it based on? Cheap cotton and cheap coal. And the whole system falls apart without that. Now, does capitalism come to an end without that? I don't think so. You have that's where we need to understand the co-produced reality, that if you don't have the Mississippi Delta delivering its cheap cotton into Manchester's textile mills, you have rising cost of production, and England stays what England was, a kind of middle-income, semi-peripheral zone in the world economy. And then even before, how do you see the co-production of nature? What did the English agricultural revolution do in the 16th and 17th century but set up new possibilities for appropriating the unpaid work energy of the soils, of these agro-ecosystems, and transforming it through a new set of property relations into a way to simultaneously generate cheap food and cheap energy, cheap food and cheap labor power. So you see, it's always co-produced. But the danger is that we fall back into a dualism where we see that what humans are doing, it becomes co-production. Capitalist co-production depends on extra human natures, which it does, but it also depends on reshaping family forms in order to supply cheap labor power into the circuit of capital. That's most famously taken up in the history of depeasantization and agrarian restructuring in what we call the Global South today, but also applies to the history of Western Europe and the work of Charles and Louise Tilly, of Wally Seacombe especially, help us understand that these dynamics are not limited to extra-human nature, but in fact, family history needs to be put squarely into our thinking about capitalism and these dialectics of capitalization and appropriation. But then, I think the second part is a really big question, Sheree, so it's a little bit vexing. But what I would say, what I do in the book, and what I've tried to flesh out in a series of essays, most recently, Cheap Food and Bad Climate, which is on my website, is to chart the history of industrial agriculture in the 20th century as precisely this process that both politically and in terms of the commodity system, how this works out, that you see a succession of short-lived booms that in world agriculture, as the Green Revolution globalized, it in fact stagnated, so that by the 1980s and since the 1980s, the global industrial agricultural system has very much stagnated, which explains part of the tremendous waves of dispossession that have occurred ever since. Why is it stagnated? Because the model, in one sense, is a question of taps and sinks. That is a moment of the process. But what we're seeing today is a shift, a new layer of contradictions, which is what I call the rise of negative value, through climate change, through super weeds that resist the glyphosate regimes of Roundup Ready soy and all the rest. We are seeing the emergence not just of extra human natures that are hostile to capital accumulation, but we're also seeing the rise of a new ontological politics through food sovereignty and other kind of sovereignty cognate movements. So I think that's the rise of negative value and the super weed effect and the growing hostility of certain forms of extra human nature is in fact bundled up with a new ontological politics that are human initiated, I would say, not human reducible, but human initiated, that we need to think about this new layer of contradictions, which I would call negative value, which overlay and reinforce the old problems of depletion that we've seen. And climate change, of course, is throwing everything into question and is so fundamental that cheap food will never return. And in fact, the problem is that, you know, what's the expression? You know, if your only tool is a hammer, then the whole world looks like a nail. Well, that's capitalism today. That's how it approaches industrial agriculture, right? We need more and more and more and more, which is ramping up climate change. Climate change is undermining industrial agriculture, and so on and so forth. Climate change and forestry together, the biggest contributor to greenhouse gases.
Down here, and then please.
You might have answered it, but I have to ask it more simply for my understanding. What do you say to the pro-neoliberal discourse, the pro-neoliberal camp, the globalization camp, the development discourse camp, who say the end of cheap nature, great.
Yeah.
Rising costs of labor in China, fantastic, they can afford Gucci. The end of oil. We need the end of oil for technology to solve our problems.
Well, in one sense, I say that's terrific, because in order for capitalism to pay the true costs of its own, say, energy production or food production, capitalism will come to an end. Because the accumulation of capital is a system of unpaid costs. I think that's been the insight of ecological economics going all the way back to William Capp in the 1950s. But what's been ignored is capitalism is also a system of unpaid work. And so the end of cheap nature is also the end of that unpaid work, which is what's left out of that neoliberal discourse. So great. I mean, that's why I always thought this sort of wages for housework argument from the 70s. Yeah, that was entirely revolutionary in the sense that if there were wages for housework, capitalism would fall apart because it wouldn't you wouldn't be able to accumulate any capital.
Thanks again, Jason. I'm just flipping back through my 7 closely written pages. What happens after Jason? So again, I'm going to try and come at a slightly offbeat angle free this time and ask, what do you think the implications are in your sketching out of the world ecology paradigm for a theory of ideology. I mean specifically because you rightly emphasize the material effectivity of symbolic production. The suggestion is that ideology is of course an ecological process, that it allows not just for the setting of policy agenda or whatever, but also acts upon the world in ways that we still don't really have an appropriate language.
As ways of what? Normalizing and naturalizing the relations between humans and the rest of nature? That,
yes, but also to sort of reflect and describe, action.
The categories themselves, yeah.
But it also suggests that there's if you go through the phases of a Marxist theory of ideology, from Marx's, flipping the world, the world upside down to along the lines of a camera obscura to an Althusserian mode of sort of material interpolation, you get to a point where ideology means less a positive set of affirmations or tenets to be proclaimed as guides for action, and more as a zone of exclusion. What is not attended to, what is off the agenda, as in the way that capitalism puts off the
agenda. So making unpaid work
social, exactly.
Invisible, yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything to be teased out further?
I think there's so much to be teased out. And I'm not sure how to answer. This is, in some ways, I'm an old-fashioned economic historian who's sort of seen the light and making my way slowly towards it. I think the way that I deal with these questions, which I think is still somewhat fairly crude, and I think that this is one of the major areas we need to explore and to elaborate from a world ecological point of view, is precisely how elements of reality or the web of life are made invisible, and how those invisibilities are in fact constitutive. So that is my critique of this Cartesian ideology, which I think is very much has been very much ingested and in a way just taken for granted by almost all Marxists, is to see these this dualism as kind of a basic structure of reality in general, rather than as a specific capitalist project. And the good news is, I think that we are seeing the unraveling of that hegemony, of that cultural hegemony of the, what do we call it, the two cultures, maybe, but much more than that. I think also of this divide between capitalization and appropriation, that what we're seeing in late capitalism is, over the past 40 years, has been this sort of mounting awareness of care work, of domestic work, of the work of extra-human natures as constitutive. But by and large, we haven't crossed the Rubicon yet, and that's what we need to do. We need to cross to the other side so that we can begin to build. I think we need a critique, but we also need to transcend it into new workable models and approaches. Yeah, we'll have to talk more about it
over here and then in the corner.
Yeah, so you've been talking like about values in cell nature, but I wonder if you could elaborate a bit more on the implications for, say, human animal relations and our kind of identification with animals, and I wonder if you could say a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I go back to somebody like Jason Hribo, who's one of Linnabaugh's students. Are animals part of the working class? And it's a great question. But I think it's also confused. And Haraway is much the same way when she mentions, the only time she ever mentions surplus value, to my knowledge, she says, well, working dogs on a farm, they also produce surplus value. No, in fact, they don't. But she's missed the more interesting point, that they are directly constitutive of the relations that do produce surplus value. So I think it is arbitrary how capitalism sort of sets this up, that it's not just humans who produce surplus value, but only really a small layer of humanity is ever directly engaged in the production of surplus value. And in fact, the real story is in how that gets connected up with the wider historical geographical processes of appropriation. So I think that's, I'm going to keep it short and say, that relation is one of appropriation, and it's that distinction. The distinction, of course, between humans and other and non-human animals, of course, is very long-standing. But what capitalism does is hardens that into a dualism and makes that one of the organizing principles of its praxis of external nature.
In the back, yeah, the person in the last row, you want to mention. That's me. So, yeah, one can only applaud your attempt to go beyond certain binaries. What may be a bit problematic is that you see this going beyond as going beyond Cartesian thinking, and which then leads to you producing another binary, which is between Cartesian and post-Cartesian thought.
That's a distinction. Was Marx recreating a binary and saying, well, we need to have a philosophy of internal relations?
Many people, I don't think all binaries are bad. I just think this one particularly may be bad because the only real existing instance of post-Cartesianism is postmodernism, and you yourself had to mention Bruno Latour as an example of post-Cartesian thought, and Bruno Latour is a guy who says capitalism doesn't exist. Mm. So maybe that's not... Maybe Cartesianism versus post-Cartesianism is one of these bad binaries, and maybe the relevant binary is within Descartes himself, and that's between cogito and res cogitans. Cogito for Descartes is the non-human in the humans, the non-human core. The drive to think is the non-human core in humanity. So mm-hmm. there alone you have an attempt to go beyond the bad binary that's usually ascribed to Descartes.
I actually agree with that. I mean,
just one last. So,
yeah.
So cogito is modern thought. Mm. And I think modern thinking is the only tool that can help you or all of us to actually conceptualize what you presented as attempts to go beyond binaries. So bundles, web of webs, oikos. These are, I think, at this point, still metaphors. And it's only something as Cartesianism that can help us produce concepts. And also, in the end, it can help us go beyond your last point, which was the real limit to capital is capital itself. Well, this also is a postmodern Marx. This is the Marx of general intellect, Grundrisse. Whereas in Capital, which is a text that very much works with binaries, not just goes beyond it, there's no illusion that capital in das Kapital, capital is the subject, and only capital will tell us where its limit is. Maybe the lack of resources may be a problem for us, but maybe what if capital will somehow go beyond it?
No, I think for Marx is very. I think I just see things a bit different. First of all, making Descartes the boogeyman for it all. Of course, we could just as easily call this a Baconian dualism, or we could find other candidates for sure. So we're dealing with a series of I think moments of a dialectical synthesis in which we do have to name, and which vocabulary is important. I guess I wouldn't look to Descartes for a lot of inspiration. I would go to a lot of other folks first, even in the continental tradition, Spinoza, Hegel, Marx. Marx is very clear in his general law of underproduction, which he articulates in Volume 3, that the underproduction of circulating capital, of raw materials and energy, is in fact a central problem for capitalism. And so that's really fundamental to this. So the end of cheap nature is not an epiphenomenal issue for capital. I don't see dialectical synthesis and transcendence as the production of binaries. I think that creates a false collapsing of distinction and dualism. Yes, I'm sympathetic to, I'm personally not a huge fan of Latour, But I think that we do need to give credit where credit is due to elements of a tradition of relational thinking. Latour deserves mention because he's well known. I would look, and my own tradition goes to the tradition of Ullmann and Kosek and Marx and Hopkins and that tradition of the philosophy of internal relations, which I think is indeed useful. I don't think it's about the creation of binaries. In fact, I think it's a method that gets us beyond those.
Because we're very tight for time, but I've promised the last two questions, let's take them as a group, and then Jason can respond to them. So George, and then in the back as well.
Thanks. Third time around, this is making more sense to me. And so just to outline what I'm thinking in response to what you've been saying, I'm thinking about the relativization of cheap, for cheap, and it's that an image of a burning ice cube on the cover of New Scientist last year suggests that actually we're going to keep redefining those cheaps in terms of how much profit can be accumulated. And I'm wondering if there is an end point to that, if the idea of the end of cheap nature even exists, and if it's not just a narrative trope that we're accustomed to, and if actually the trajectory is endless.
Yeah, no, it's not. And I'll get to it after we get the second.
I'm a bit bothered by the warning you keep repeating about making the distinction between economic capital and other forms of capital supposedly implied in much of Marxist analysis. But I mean, in Marxist capital, capital is anything but, you know, economic capital. I mean, it's constantly repeated that to see it as economic capital is basically the methodological mistake of bourgeois political economy. I mean, Marx, as everybody knows, is, you know, capital is a social social relation. It's an organizational principle that, you know, produces the symbolic orders that you talked about and the socio-economic consequences that that we all see. So to expand this to the story about nature, I mean, for the concept of capital as found in Marx, in Das Kapital, there is you know, no simple binary between between capital and nature. I mean, it simply doesn't exist because under the historical order of capitalism, you know, nature is simply seen as capital, as potentiality maybe of capital. There is no, I mean, it's a type of, you know, singular interrelation. There is no binary. So I mean, having this in mind, I'm kind of failing to see where the theoretical innovation in the concept of, you know, cheap nature that you explained is. So if you could elaborate a bit.
Well, perhaps you've come across Marxists who have been writing about the centrality of the four chiefs, perhaps under other names. But I've read a lot of political economy for the past for about 25 years. And in fact, if you look at the political economy of resources and energy and accounts, and just to leave out the question of cheap food and labor power, which I've written quite a bit about, you'll go looking for a long time to see a model of accumulation crisis in play. Where is that model? Is it in Arrighi? No. Is it in Brenner? No. Is it in Dumanel and Levy? No. I mean, let's, you know, is it in Mandel? A little bit. I'm sort of astounded by a comment, I'm sorry to say, that says, well, Marxists have always recognized cheap nature. I don't think so.
I mentioned Marx specifically. Marx from
Marx states, as, I mean, I agree with everything you said about Marx. I don't think that everybody understands. I don't agree with that part of what you said, but people...
I mean, I said that everybody understands that capital is a social relation.
Right, but then once we get to talking about capitalism, for most Marxists still, it's capitalism as an economic system. Mm-hmm. And that's a real pervasive problem on the left. And then there's also a problem in the way that you framed it, that is, there's a sort of system of social relations that then goes out and does things to nature. Maybe I misheard you, though. Yeah, I don't think in Marx's view, capital is already a relation of human and extra-human nature. So on that part, but the methodological implications and the narrative strategies have not been followed through. So that's the innovation. How do we follow through on that? This question of is it endlessly relative? No. Why? Because that capitalism tends to increase the cost of production very, very fast. So the cost of production rise, and that squeezes the rate of accumulation, and that's just a brutally simplified model. But we are increasingly back to the problem that Marx identifies in his question of the working day, only this time without Ireland. There's no external Ireland. So in China, for instance, you see rising labor costs. And yes, where are the Chinese and other international capitalists looking to? Well, Cambodia. Cambodia is not very big. And the Cambodians have figured out how to use the internet, what do you know? And they also figured out how to organize. So instead of 20 years to organize, it takes them 5 years to organize. So there's a question of the movement. So the question of the rise of negative value is not simply a question of the super weeds and extra human nature, but of this new, of a new politics that understands that that nature, power, and capital form a dynamic unity. Mm-hmm. So,
please put your hands together for. Lunch is in the foyer. So I'm going
to
That's right. And I don't think that's